And welcome everyone to the Common Anomaly Podcast. I'm your host, Stuart James. Joining me today, my brother, once again, Clayton James. Welcome back for episode 5. How's it going?
Well, it's going good. Thanks for having me back again.
Yeah, so soon. No problem. You know, I was kind of thinking about doing a solo episode because I felt like I wanted to practice just being able to talk to myself and do a show that way. But when I landed on the topic for this week, I thought it just made sense to invite you back because I know this is a subject matter that you know a lot about, and I'm sure the audience will benefit from everything you know on this subject. Speaking of which, it's 2 episodes in a row. I forgot to introduce the topic of the episode. So for the audience, our episode today will be First Contact. We're going to be discussing and exploring the idea that humanity is on the verge of making first contact with an alien civilization. Has it happened already? Is it about to happen? Is it 100 years away? We're going to dive into that and discuss. So that's our topic for today. But before we dive in, I did want to cover a little show news. So for if there's new listeners out there, what this show is all is about is a kind of just light entertainment discussion about fringe topics in the paranormal, esoteric realm, UFOs, Bigfoot, everything that kind of fits into that bucket. Don't consider it too educational. It's more for fun and entertainment. And just having a good time and letting our minds wander and explore these ideas. So welcome everybody if you're new, and if you're coming back, thank you for joining us for the ride. Before we dive into it, just a bit of show news. So we've made some strides this week. I've been tinkering around with my hosting service, and so as promised back at the beginning of the month in my first episode, we are now available on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Audible, just about everywhere that I can push this podcast out, you should be able to find us. If you are listening somewhere where you can comment, like, subscribe, leave a review, please do so. It helps a lot trying to get this show out to as many ears as possible. And also, if you visit the RS homepage, you'll find I've added a donate button. So I am kind of taking one tiny step towards monetization. I'm not doing subscriptions or anything like that. It's a free show. But I just wanted to put that button out there. If someone was so inclined, you're enjoying this show, you want to support your new favorite podcast, hit that donate button. You can donate to my PayPal there. And I know I do have a lot of friends and family listening to the show. They're my first supporters. That button's not for you, all right? Well, let's just leave that out there. I'm trying to build a following here. And I do want to just be able to cover costs as I continue this venture into the future. I got to pay for the hosting, and I'm trying to get better equipment to provide the best quality product. So if you're so inclined and feel like supporting, there's a button there. Just look up the RRS and you can donate. So yeah, that's that. So now that that's all out of the way, all the shameless plugs, let's let's dive into the subject matter. I pitched this idea for this episode to you earlier this week.
Yeah.
Tell me, what were your thoughts? Were you jazzed? Were you like, oh no, shit, why do I have to do this again?
No, I was excited to come back. And honestly, this is something I could just talk about for hours and hours. You know, contact, has it happened already? Will it happen? You know, for the past few years, I was thinking, you know, collectively, we really ought to hose ourselves down and get our act together, because it feels like we might be getting some visitors soon. You know,
is that so? Okay. All right. What leads you to that conclusion?
Well, so many stories in the news seem to align and point in that direction. You know, as we touched on briefly the last time I was here, the UAP phenomenon, not the drones, but preceding that, UAPs, more and more reports from the military. And they actually had to change the name from UFO to UAP because they found that in the military there was such a stigma around the phrase UFO, but so much was happening. They redesignated it just to reduce the stigma, people wouldn't feel like, you know, their careers would be ruined and people would think they were crackpots for reporting on this.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does feel like it's become a lot more socially acceptable, even in just the past 10 years, to have conversations about UFOs or UAPs.
Yeah, and there's a lot there, and there's a lot of evidence, especially from the military. You know, these military pilots, those aircraft they're flying, they have a lot of instruments, they have a lot of cameras on them that capture quite a bit. So it's not just people talking. You know, so you have those stories, and at the same time, you have things like Tabby Star and Oumuamua.
Well, and that's really where I wanted to come from, at least to start this conversation, is I feel like, of course, those that are kind of knee-deep in the UFO realm might say that this conversation is old hat. You know, there's people that are really into the abduction phenomenon would say that, you know, this is an old conversation, we're five steps ahead of this. But I really wanted to, at least to launch this conversation, to start from kind of an examination of just recent, very white world establishment science discoveries that seem to be stacking up over the past couple decades, leading us closer and closer to this inevitable, what I feel is probably an inevitable realization that we're not alone in the universe, that we live in a green universe, as it were, that life is everywhere, and that there is probably neighboring civilizations not too far off in our local galaxy that we might have contact with. And so I do have a bunch of tabs, like we talked about before the show, mostly for reference. We're not going to read articles out to you today, folks. I want it to be a little more of a free-flowing conversation. But I do have a couple tabs for reference. And I mean, going all the way back to the 1960s, we have the Drake Equation, which I think a lot of people will be familiar with. But just to recap, Frank Drake was a physicist, and he was trying to come up with a way to quantify how many intelligent, technologically advanced civilizations might be out there in the universe. And so he developed an equation that was, you know, X number of planets in the universe, you know, just based on mass, a reasonable assumption, how many of those would have the chemical materials required for life, how many would actually develop life, and leading you to the end result of how many intelligent civilizations, alien civilizations would be out there. And it's not meant to come to an actual answer, because all those values are we don't have exact numbers. So you're applying your best guess for all of those values. And so there's a whole range of answers. But I don't think any of them that anybody's that has experimented with this equation has come to an absolute zero. There's none, right?
Yeah.
And really what Drake was trying to, he wasn't trying to come to a definitive answer. What he was actually trying to achieve is what we're doing on this episode, to create a real dialogue among scientists about this subject of, are we alone in the universe or not? And I would argue, my stance has always come to, well, there must be, because we're here.
Yeah.
That's my first kind of logical point I always come to. We exist, we're technologically advanced, we're exploring space, so surely there's more. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, the more science moves forward, the more actual numbers you can plug into the variables in that equation, and we're always, you know, refining our techniques, we're getting more accurate information and reevaluating old information about, you know, the universe and how it works and just what's out there. And, you know, with how big, you know, you look up at the sky and every star you see is actually in our galaxy. Mm. And how many stars are in our galaxy alone? I think it numbers in the trillions, in the hundreds of trillions, maybe.
Yeah,
but at least in the trillions.
I failed to look up that particular factoid before the show, but yeah, a lot.
it's in the hundreds of billions, not trillions. Sorry, and each one of those is in our galaxy, and how many galaxies are in the observable universe? That number's in the trillions. So, with so many stars out there. And, you know, they did an experiment in the 70s where they were trying to determine, you know, how basic primitive life started on Earth. And what this experiment did is it took, you know, the basic chemical compounds that were found in the early Earth, you know, inorganic compounds, not life. Just chemicals.
Yep.
And put it in a chamber that simulated the atmospheric conditions of the early Earth. And then they would add kind of an electrical discharge to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm familiar with this.
Yeah, yep. To simulate, you know, the electrical storms that would have been happening. And after running this experiment, what they found was that within that chamber formed
amino acids,
organic compounds, not life, but basically the building blocks of life. Well, recently, I was reading last week, I forget which university conducted this experiment. Basically, they conducted a more refined version of this experiment because we have more accurate data on the exact composition of the early Earth. We have more accurate data on the conditions. So they did a more refined version of this experiment now that science has advanced a bit further since the 70s. And what they found was what formed within the chamber was beyond basic organic compounds. They found what formed was almost like proto-DNA. Not quite what we know as DNA, but a primitive version of it.
Like RNA or something.
Yeah, a primitive version of it that could actually replicate crude versions of itself, you know, synthesizing that from the material in the chamber.
Yeah.
So you got to think with so many stars and, you know, and we're discovering now that the majority of those stars have planets around them. We're discovering so many exoplanets now. I don't know how many exoplanets we've discovered, but it's probably in the hundreds of thousands just by looking at the stars that are close enough to us that we can detect those.
I'm not sure of the exact number. I know it's definitely in the thousands. We might even be in the tens of thousands at this point.
But more stars have planets around them than don't. That's the norm, not the exception.
And that just that piece of knowledge coming into humanity's sphere, that's fairly recent because in the 80s, it's like we didn't even know that in the 80s. Right? Mm-hmm. All we had was our own solar system for a template. And sure, it was a pretty safe assumption, but we didn't really know for sure until like the late 80s, early 90s, the first, I think, exoplanets were discovered, right? Mm-hmm. Until then, for all we knew, it was completely barren beyond our own solar system, which seems like an absurd assumption, but if you don't really know until you know, right?
I mean, we didn't really know for sure that the Earth was a sphere until we went up into space. We could infer it with you know, a great deal of certitude, but not 100%. You know, we kind of need to see something to know it's there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's probably why there's still so many people out there on the internet that think the Earth is actually flat. It's a conspiracy by Big Globe.
We need to send them up, right? We need to get them up there so we can just end that debate once and for all.
Yeah.
Well, and since we're on that point of just kind of the chemical composition of life, I feel like that's something that more and more is pointing to a very green universe. Because you've had discoveries. Oh, see if I can find the tab now. I'm jumping around here a bit. Astronomers may have found signatures of life in the clouds of Venus. So I believe this was a discovery of phosphine gas in the clouds of Venus. Yeah, very much pointing to life and the upper atmosphere of Venus. So Venus, the surface is not hospitable, very hospitable to life. You know, it's intense pressure. It's extremely hot. Not very conducive to life.
It's a hell
It's
planet.
a hell planet. Yeah, but the upper atmosphere, there's certain layers in the upper atmosphere that are actually quite temperate and chemically conducive to life. And actually, if we had kind of floating cities, like if you imagine Cloud City from
Yeah.
Star Wars, if you had something like that, infrastructure like that in Venus would actually be quite hospitable. And recent observations of Venus are showing phosphine gas emissions, which is not like, I guess, 100% giveaway, but it's a very strong indicator that there's at least some kind of biology happening in the atmosphere of Venus. And then there's, I don't have a tab up for it, but it just popped into my brain just now. I think it was a couple of years ago, they found on the surface, the exterior of the ISS, of the International Space Station, they found bacterial cultures that were thriving. And so, not of extraterrestrial origin, the thinking is it's contamination from just, the materials being constructed on Earth. But also, perhaps that just there's those extremophile bacterias that are actually very high up in our own atmosphere. Because the ISS isn't in deep space. It's not very high. It's barely outside of our atmosphere.
Yeah, it's not actually very high at all when you
Yeah,
look at
it's
it.
lower than most satellites, right? Than most communication satellites. It's not super far out in space. And so the thinking is that these extremophile bacteria are actually, they live in the upper atmosphere, in the upper edge of the atmosphere, and that's how they may have contacted the exterior of the ISS, and they're thriving, right? So if you have, you're basically in space, if you have organisms there in the clouds of Venus, we're now taking much closer looks at the subsurface oceans of moons of our gas giants like Titan and Enceladus and Europa, all strong candidates for and those are planetary bodies that are well outside our habitable zone. If you were looking from some other solar system at ours and trying to consider, okay, where's the best pocket of life? That's what we do. What's the habitable zone of that other solar system out there? Those bodies are in our outer solar system, well outside of our habitable zone, and they're the best candidates in our solar system for finding extraterrestrial life. So
I think when we talk about a habitable zone, we tend to lean towards, we're very human centered in how we define that. Like you were just saying, some of our best candidates for life are outside that zone. And what was who was the guy in Jurassic Park? Jeffrey Goldblum, what did he say? Life will find a way.
Yeah, life finds a way.
But, we are very human-centered in how we define a habitable zone. And I think, if life will evolve, at least it has on Earth, anywhere it can, absolutely anywhere it can. Anywhere there's water, basically. Even,
Or some other medium like water.
And it will adapt to the conditions of that environment, no matter how extreme they are. So, life, on other around other stars, other planets, it's probably going to look quite different than us. It's probably going to function quite differently from us.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, right now we're just talking about
Microbes.
I'm keeping that in. I'm not gonna edit that out. Microbes, yes, let's just call it microbes. Flub. But basic single cellular life, right? Which would be a major discovery on its own. But I think we're more and more, I think it's a safe assumption based on what we've just discussed, that life is probably everywhere. The ingredients for life are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But what about intelligent life? Well, what about that next step where you have thinking creatures that we can converse with that are maybe technologically developed, industrialized? And that makes me want to jump over to Oumuamua.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned at the beginning of the episode, I like when I pull up the search for Oumuamua, the first thing I get is a picture of the Battlestar Galactica, which is about the right shape. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's one of the possible shapes.
Yeah.
Because they say, right, with Oumuamua, right, it's either like elongated like that, or it's flat.
Like a pancake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like potentially a solar sail. So, but just for those who are listening that might not know, Oumuamua is the first interstellar object detected passing through our solar system. So we're used to seeing the planetary bodies and asteroids that we know are within the confines of our solar system. But in 2017, humanity discovered the first interloper, the first object that originated from outside of our solar system, and it took a kind of really fast path straight through to our sun and whiplashed out the other way, and we just happened to catch up to it, I guess, as it's on its way out of the solar system. It's still making its way on its way outside of our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a monumental scientific discovery just on that basis. It's the first time we've seen something like that happen. That we've had the instruments and the capability to observe something like that. But it immediately got way more interesting because there's certain speculation that Oumuamua may in fact be artificial, might not just be a rock flying through space. And there's certain evidence that kind of points to that this might actually be the case. Popularized by, I want to get his credentials correct, theoretical physicist Avi Loeb. You may have heard him. He definitely gets out there a lot. He wrote a book about it, and he's no slouch.
He's at Harvard, right?
Yeah, he's Harvard University professor of science, astrophysics. He chaired the Department of Astronomy from 2011 to 2020. Founded the Black Hole Initiative in 2016. So that's just a couple notes from his bio. There's a lot more there. But basically, you know, he's entrenched in the scientific community. He's definitely gotten a lot of flack for kind of postulating that Oumuamua is perhaps of an artificial origin. But there's good reason for him to perhaps think that. The speed at which it's leaving our solar system is a bit confounding. We can't really explain it. It's got no cometary tail,
mm-hmm.
But it seems to be moving faster than we would predict.
Well, our whole encounter with Oumuamua was unusual from the get-go, because you think about objects moving through space. It's all relative, really. You know, the Earth is moving around the sun, and the sun it's rotating around the galactic center. These galaxies, they're all moving relative to each other. But something Avi Loeb talks about is Oumuamua didn't really visit us.
Hmm. More our solar system,
yeah,
intercepted it in interstellar space.
Yeah, Oumuamua, yeah, was in the frame of reference of the galaxy, of our galaxy. Oumuamua was actually stationary. It was actually at a relative state of rest, which in and of itself is unusual.
Hmm.
And our solar system kind of slammed into it. And you know, as it passed through our solar system, you know, as it curved around the sun and it exited our solar system, it sped up,
yeah,
more than could be accounted for by it, you know, slingshotting around the sun by gravity more than that could account for. And to me, that almost looks like a course correction.
Right.
Like, it didn't want to be captured by our solar system.
Yeah. Well, and I found it interesting just the trajectory it took through the solar system, because it went straight through the middle. You know, it's not like it brushed just on the outskirts. It went right straight through the inner solar system. And actually, the closest planetary body it passed by was Earth.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm pretty sure, I have to look up the details, but I'm pretty sure its closest planetary pass was Earth. I mean, it did get close to the sun, because obviously it slung, like you said, slingshotted around the sun and put it on a new trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that interesting, just from if you wanted to take an observation of our solar system's habitable zone, you'd want something that had a trajectory that put it on a course straight through our inner solar system. And it would give you the best opportunity for an escape vector as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But
so it could be. And like, if you want to learn more about this, just look up Avi Loeb. I'll leave notes in the show notes. And he's on all kinds of other podcasts. John Michael Gaudier, Angry Astronaut, who's our other favorite?
Isaac Arthur,
yeah. So just do a quick search for Avi Loeb and maybe check out some of those other YouTube channels and podcasts, and you'll get much more in-depth information than you're getting here if you want to really deep dive into this. But yeah, it seems like there's a lot of evidence that points to the fact that Oumuamua may in fact be an artificial satellite, or maybe just an old piece of space junk from some other civilization that's maybe degraded, you know, maybe been floating in space for a long time, or maybe somebody left it there to intercept our solar system because they wanted to take a look and see if there was life here, you know. Yeah, maybe it's reporting back right now.
I mean, it's interesting to think what an object like that could be. Just some old space junk. Maybe it's a probe, you know, just the way it was at a state of rest, you know.
Yeah.
Relative to the rest of the galaxy. Yeah,
because most things in interstellar space probably wouldn't be in a state of rest, right? They would be moving.
Yeah, it's really unusual. And, you know, for ourselves, we talk about, you know, sending probes out to explore space. You know, I mean, we've already sent out the Voyager probes. We're talking now about projects like Breakthrough Starshot, using solar sails to get to the nearest stars. But, you know, what if someone or something out there took another tack? Like, you know, we're not going to go to other stars. We're just going to put a stationary probe out there. Let the other stars come to us.
Yeah. It's the most efficient use of energy, right?
Yeah.
You get it out there and it just waits for your target to come to it.
Yeah.
Right? So from a conservation of energy standpoint, that would be an efficient way of getting a probe to your target.
It'd be a very long wait.
It would, right? It would. But we don't know what kind of timescales we're talking about for another civilization.
Yeah, because we do tend to think of things in terms of our lifespans.
Mm.
You know, that's why interstellar travel is so intimidating to us.
I thought about this because our solar system, we tend to think of it as stationary, but it doesn't. It rotates through our galaxy the same way we rotate around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Our solar system rotates around the center of the galaxy. What if an ancient, technologically advanced civilization on Earth left it behind on the last cycle through the galaxy? Boom!
I mean, well, I would have to look this up, because
what if the ancient Atlanteans left that behind the last time we passed through?
How long does it take our solar system to revolve around the galaxy? Has Earth even been around that long?
That's a good question. I don't know. I just had that idea right now. I was like, wouldn't that be cool?
It'd be interesting to do the math on that.
Yeah.
And see how viable
I wish
is.
I had that idea before the show started so I could have looked up those specifics. Yeah, do the math and see. But that just popped into my head right now. That's a cool thought. Okay, so let's move on from Oumuamua because there's a couple other things in this case we're trying to build here. Tabby Star. So are you familiar with Tabby Star?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So just a little background on what we'll refer to as Tabby Star. It's a star designated KIC 8462 blah, 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 blah in the Kepler catalog. And it's gotten a lot of attention over the past, how long? Several years?
I think maybe 2015.
2015, so about a decade. For having unusual dimming. So we're able to observe stars really closely now at a distance. And kind of you look at dips in light. And that's how we discover a lot of exoplanets. You're able to take a look at the light profile of a star. And you can see if an object is traversing between you and the star that dims its light. So if a big planet traverses across the star as it's orbiting, you'll see a big dip in the light. And so we're looking for exoplanets, and we discover this very weird star that's got very unusual and erratic dimming patterns that aren't consistent. Mm-hmm. And some people have speculated. There's a lot of conflicting theories that I think, you know, the established scientific world would say, oh, it's dust or it's a moon that's been smashed to bits with chunks of it flying in front of the star. But there's been some speculation that it's actually a sign of a megastructure being built within the solar system. Basically, the concept of a Dyson swarm or a Dyson sphere. Mm-hmm. And so a little context for people who might not know what that is. It's basically a giant structure that you would build around your star, either a bunch of satellites in conjunction. If people know Halo, the game Halo, it's kind of that same idea, a big ring around a planet, or it could be multiple rings or individual bodies. I think most people lean towards a Dyson swarm being like a bunch of satellites.
I mean, if you're a fan of Star Trek, this was my first exposure to the idea of a Dyson sphere. In the Next Generation, the Enterprise encountered a Dyson sphere. It was a solid sphere built around a star and just clinging to the inside surface of this sphere. It was at just the right distance that there was a habitable surface clinging to the inside of this sphere.
Yeah, and that's the general idea, is that a technologically advanced civilization would be able to build on the scale of an entire solar system, basically to capture the energy of the star to fuel that civilization. And it's funny you brought that episode up. Very much we think alike. I watched that episode last night because I wanted to actually grab a clip of Patrick Stewart describing a Dyson sphere, because I was like, that'll be a way better breakdown.
You should put that in.
I was going to record it, the clip, this morning, but I ran out of time because I was cleaning.
I'm sure you can put that in and post.
Yeah, I probably could. I could probably squeeze it in there. Maybe I will. Maybe that'll be a special treat for everyone if they're interested. So that's the idea. I wish I'd dug this piece of information up, but I believe a second survey that was done just a couple of years ago, maybe just last year, I think I saw this on the Angry Astronaut. He was covering Tabby Star, and I guess they did a survey of all the surrounding stars, the closest stars to Tabby Star, and found that there were multiple other stars in the vicinity of Tabby Star that had similar profiles, dimming profiles.
Oh, like they're colonizing almost.
Right, and they were all, get this, they were all around main sequence stars. It's not like it was every star closest to Tabby Star, but it was they were all in the same category of star. So it's like if you were a civilization capable of building such a megastructure,
so like and traveling, we're not going to bother with red dwarfs.
Exactly,
you know, can't get enough juice out of a red
dwarf.
You're
going to go to stars that look like your star, mm-hmm. right? Similar environment, and I guess a survey of nearby stars indicated that there is a pocket. So to me, that feels like on the surface an indication of like a galactic empire. Almost. Hey, what do you think about that?
Well, that's absolutely terrifying.
Isn't it?
Well, I think it's interesting. You brought up how, a lot of people are dismissing Tabby's star as, a dust cloud or some natural phenomenon orbiting this star. And I think that has to be our go-to explanation. I mean, we can't make assumptions, but
absolutely.
But when you think of potentially a civilization that's capable of building a structure like that, either whether it be a solid shell around the star or a swarm of orbiting objects to harness all its energy, a civilization that advanced, us from our limited perspective. Not just now, but for all time. Are we going to be able to really distinguish the actions of a civilization like that from nature?
Mm.
They say that sufficiently advanced technology, sufficiently advanced science, looks like magic.
Yeah.
If we went back 100,000 years and showed primitive humans, a cell phone.
Yeah.
They'd think it was magic. If there were people back then walking around with cell phones, they would think these people were gods.
Yeah.
So if there's technology out there, technologically advanced civilizations,
maybe we can't distinguish that from natural processes.
We've never been able to distinguish that from natural processes. Some things that maybe, as we looked up at the sky, things we always thought were natural phenomenon. Maybe they're not.
Yeah. Well, I've even heard it theorized that pulsars could be like a super advanced form of navigation and communication system on like a galactic scale. Or a universal scale, which would mean we're very far behind, right? We're
working on it.
Yeah, but that's a good point, and I understand the kind of institutional perspective of playing your cards close and not jumping to conclusions. That makes a lot of sense, but still, I feel like okay, here we are. Let's just recap where we've gotten so far. I think we've got a couple other cards up our sleeve. But so we're seeing chemical signatures of life around Venus and all of our solar system. So life is probably persistent and ubiquitous in the universe. We've got interstellar visitors like Oumuamua that are at least potentially artificial. We've got signs of not just one, but multiple Dyson spheres. Another recent astronomical survey aided by AI found, I guess, up to 60 candidates, similar to Tabby Star, for additional megastructures, not just by the dimming pattern, but also the radiation profile coming from the solar system. Mm-hmm. So we've got interstellar visitors, Dyson spheres everywhere, life is ubiquitous. Can we say that we're not alone? Is it all starting to add up to the point where we can definitively say we're not alone in the universe, and that we have brothers and sisters out there to be sought out and go say hi?
Well, we've also got...
What's your opinion?
My opinion is there...
I better check to make sure we're still recording. It's been a while since it. Oh, yeah.
there really just has to be life out there in space. I mean,
that seems like mathematically,
with that many stars, that many galaxies,
it's a near impossibility.
It's nearly impossible. There's not. Is it life that is, close enough for, to contact us or for us to contact, be detectable to us? I mean, you think about Fermi's paradox. For myself, I never considered that a paradox. And for those that don't know, I'm sure everyone knows this. You know, the Fermi's paradox is, if it's so mathematically likely that life exists out there in space, why aren't we seeing aliens all the time? I never considered that a paradox, because if you think, how does SETI look for alien life? They're looking for radio signals, right?
Well, that's one avenue. They've branched out, but that's one avenue.
So if you look at the size of the Milky Way galaxy, it is, I think it's 100,000 light years across. Now, we've been broadcasting radio signals for approximately 100 years. So we are only detectable by the very means we're using to try and search for alien life. We ourselves are only detectable by
a radius of 100 light years.
Yeah, by probably less than 1% of the rest of the galaxy. We do not have the technology to even detect ourselves from relatively not that far away.
Yeah.
So there's no paradox there to me.
Well, and one of my favorite theories I've heard about the Fermi paradox, about why we're not seeing alien civilizations everywhere, is that maybe it does happen semi-frequently, but it's not so much a distance in space, but a distance in time.
Yeah.
That a technologically advanced civilization is such a rare thing that one pops up here, but they might be separated by 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. So a civilization might rise, fall, and go extinct before we pop up. And it seems like the universe is empty, but just the vastness of time, not just space, but time through the universe, separates us from contact.
Like I said, we've only been broadcasting radio signals for 100 years. We've only been, around as a species, like biologically modern humans. We've only been around for the past, I think, 200,000 years. We've only just recently, aside from just banging rocks together and being hunter-gatherers, we've only gotten down to having organized, recorded civilization as soon as it's been less than 10,000 years. I think 6 or 7,000 years we've had that. And how old is the universe? It's
14 billion.
14 billion years?
Roughly. 13.8 or something like that.
And I'm sure, life is probably common. Intelligent life might be more rare. Well, it's certainly more rare.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that's out there too. But how long lived is it?
And I think there's a distinction as well between just intelligent life and technological civilization.
Yeah.
Because we have many other examples of intelligent life on Earth besides human beings. There's a lot of aquatic life, octopi, orcas, dolphins that have very high levels of intelligence, some would argue comparable to our own, but a dolphin can't, build a radio because it doesn't have digits,
The
intelligence might be there, but that doesn't mean you're going to have an industrialized civilization.
And even with manipulative appendages, digits, the ability to fashion tools. We only figured it out quite recently.
Mm.
Like I said, for, most of that 200,000 years, we were just banging rocks together. So, you know, civilizations might pop up here and there throughout the galaxy, throughout the universe, but then fizzle out after not that long a time, you know, on a cosmic time scale. Or here's another thought, you know, they could advance to a state that doesn't even really look like life to us. You know, we were talking last time I was here about AI. You know, is the galaxy just full of advanced AIs? Maybe civilization reaches a point where they invent an AI and that takes over.
Well, when we think about the ability to travel just to the next star over, it's prohibitive with our technology in terms of a human lifespan, but it wouldn't be for a robot or for an intelligent program, you know. Yeah, maybe that's the go-to. Maybe that's the end result that every technologically advanced civilization comes to, is it's just easier to have a robot do it because we won't survive the journey.
And maybe that's the next, you know, there's this whole movement of people, the transhumanist movement that believes, you know, AI and robotics, you know, is, you know, aside from something to be feared, that's the next step in human evolution. That's going to be our replacement. That's how we evolve to the next stage, is we kind of merge with artificial intelligence, merge with machines, gain a kind of immortality that way. And maybe that's the route some civilizations go. Or maybe they die out.
Or maybe they go internal. Maybe the step towards artificial intelligence and integrating with it makes it a lot easier to enter like a matrix or something like that and create your own universe instead of trying to explore an external universe.
And that's something else there's a lot of, you know, chatter about lately is simulation theory. You know, is the world we live in really the real world, or base reality, as Elon Musk would put it? Or are we living in a giant computer simulation of one?
Did you hear just earlier this week, I think Google announced that they're building a big data center, and it's going to be solely devoted to building this massive simulation of the Earth with as many variables as possible.
I know there was a lot of announcements about, you know, AI infrastructure this week, you know, Project Stargate and all that. I didn't hear about this one specifically.
I don't know too much about it, and I didn't pull up an article. I don't have anything to reference, but I just recall seeing a blip about it on television that Google was, yeah, they had this project to build a giant simulation of Earth in super high detail to run basically predictive models. But it sounds a lot like The Matrix, right?
And of course, Google's building one.
Yeah, of course, right? Just plug us all in. We'll be batteries before you know it.
I mean, it is start to feel that way. I mean,
But I do like that simulation theory. It does make sense when you think about it, because like we just demonstrated, we're building simulations now, and we've been around for the blink of an eye. So if you imagine any other civilization that's been around longer than we have, a couple thousand years longer than we have, or millions of years longer than we have, they've probably built simulations, right? So you got to think this happens over and over. An intelligent, technologically advanced civilization rises, they make civilizations, and it's maybe populated by AIs that don't know they're in a simulation. And then those simulations make their own simulations, and those simulations make their own simulations. If that's something that
That's
is
what
a.
you call an infinite regression.
Yeah,
And it's, yeah,
I think there's a Rick and Morty episode about that. That's pretty good.
It's a little wild to think about. But yeah. you think.
Well, and people we're saying this new quantum chip that Google has, Willow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was somewhat sensationalized, that quantum computing basically is outsourcing the computation to other dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Which I think is a very sensational way of explaining what's happening in quantum computing. I think that's a... What are your thoughts there? But that's basically the same idea. Yeah. That we can't possibly... We've reached the threshold of what we can compute in classical Newtonian physics, so we're going to outsource computation to neighboring dimensions and have them do the hard work, right?
I don't really understand quantum computing.
Me neither.
But I feel like someone who did would probably think the phrase outsourcing our computation to different dimensions. I feel like someone that understood
hyper-sensational,
it.
Hyper-sensational, yeah.
Someone who understood it far better than me would probably find that to be a very glib way of putting it.
Yeah.
I don't understand it myself, but... You know, going back to what you said about like this infinite regression, and you know how we're getting very close, you know, with Google and others to, you know, simulating a reality. Think, with video games even.
Yeah.
It took us, you know, about 50 years to get from Pong to No Man's Sky.
Yeah, which is in itself basically a simulated universe.
Yeah. You know, spoilers ahead for No Man's Sky. If you haven't played it yet, you're probably not going to play it. It's been out for so long. But, I mean, the story of that game, you know, you're exploring space, and it's revealed through the story of the game that you're actually living in a simulated universe.
Yeah.
And the computer that's running it is on the verge of failing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that game.
Yeah, me too.
Wild.
But
wild,
you know, stuff. it took us 50 years to get from Pong to that. Okay. I think a civilization that's had, you know, not even
100 years.
Yeah, not even a million years head start, but even just 100 years. How far could they have gotten?
Yeah.
In so much space and so much time. There has to have been civilizations that advanced. And, you know, if you take, you know, just our small corner of space as a sample group, you know, it's promising to look at just what we found in our own backyard, as it were. You know, there was those that radio signal detected from, what was it, Proxima B?
Oh, right.
B recently.
I've had a tab on that as well. I feel like I accidentally deleted a couple tabs this morning when I was trying to refresh my memory. But yeah, that's right. And it was very controversial. I remember a couple weeks ago
been some back and forth.
There's been
on
a lot
it.
Of back and forth. Yeah, people arguing whether it's legitimate or not. Without any real resolution that I've seen. I've seen some people very quick to dismiss it. And I guess the original signal was, again, it's like about 5 years old or longer. I think 2017, 2018.
I believe 2019 is when this radio signal
was first detected.
Yeah. And it was dismissed.
The satellite.
Pretty quickly.
Satellite noise or something.
Yeah. It was dismissed as just human... background noise.
Yeah.
Like human-made background noise.
But recently another observation of it determined that's there's no way it possibly could be that.
More recently they've had a closer look at it, using a lot more data from a lot more, you know, ground stations.
Yeah.
And what they're saying is like, no, this couldn't have been just, you know, background noise coming from Earth. This definitely came from Proxima B.
Yeah.
And
it had the motion, because it had, like, redshift, right? Like, yeah. Like it displayed movement like it was orbiting, as if it was coming from a satellite orbiting another planet.
Yeah, there was a Doppler shift to the signal. And it was in, you know, a high narrow band radio frequency.
Which is where you look.
Yeah. And the reason that's, you know, where they look for artificial signals is, as far as we know, that doesn't occur naturally.
Yeah.
That only occurs artificially.
And correct me if I'm wrong. I might be wrong. But I think I recall hearing as well that the signal had modulation.
I mean, if you listen to it, it definitely sounds like it.
Right. I might be wrong about that, you know, grain of salt disclaimer. I might be wrong, but I feel like in watching some of the coverage I saw around that it's like, yeah, it was narrow band and had modulation, which would imply information in the signal, not just like
a
signal.
It's encoding some kind of data in that.
Yeah, which is incredibly exciting, right? And what are the chances that our literal next door neighbor,
you know,
would have as
a sample group, you know, our solar system and Proxima B being neighbors, and there's some sort of something sending an artificial signal. I'm stopping short of saying aliens, because everyone seems to when they talk about this. You know, that's very promising for not only lots of life in the galaxy, but lots of intelligent life.
Well, and just let's kind of go off into the world of speculation here. Not that we haven't already, but what would be the implications if that's how, say we do 5 years from now, we have better observation equipment and we take a real close look at Proxima B and determine that, yes, there's a legitimate signal and we now have contact from a seemingly alien civilization around our very next-door neighbor star system. What would be the implications of that, that they were right next to us?
I think in the immediate, I think it would cause a lot of panic. It would cause a lot of... It would cause conflict. It would cause a lot of existential dread. And there would be a conflict in the sense that there would be a lot of people that did not want to believe that. I know probably a lot of religious groups would be not willing to believe that because, you know, nothing against religion, but it's very human-centric, it's very Earth-centric, and in that this planet and us as a species are somehow special and somehow blessed. And I think that would cause a lot of upset amongst religious groups. I think in the long term, I think it would be a great thing. I think it would be a very exciting thing. If even if we had no, you know, direct interaction, no back and forth conversation, just knowing they were there, you know, who knows what level of technology they would be at, you know. Maybe they just started broadcasting radio signals. It might be Proxima B by gaslight out there, right?
Yeah. Or maybe they've been watching for a lot longer.
Maybe. Or they might just be getting started. We don't know.
Maybe they're the reason we're here in the first place. That's where my mind goes. Is maybe we're naive to the fact and we're actually in some kind of cosmological suburb. And we're actually in a very well-populated part of the galaxy.
Maybe.
And maybe, like, because this is the really out there stuff. But, you know, there's all those conspiracy theories about the moon, perhaps. Like, our Earth's moon being an artificial construct.
Yeah, you know, if it wasn't aliens, then who built the moon?
Well, there's a lot of funny things about the moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just solar eclipses or lunar eclipses rather, and how they're perfectly aligned.
Yeah, yeah, it's really unlikely, actually.
It just kind of begs you to think design, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot more than that without going down that particular rabbit hole. But yeah, maybe we're naive to our own history of why we're here in the first place. And maybe maybe there's not aliens out there, but maybe there's genetic brothers and sisters to humanity all around us.
And, also covered in an episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, and we're kind of the dumb cousins of the group.
Maybe.
That kind of forgot how we got here in the first place. And they're waiting for us to wake up and catch up to the rest of the neighborhood and join the galactic civilization.
Yeah, maybe they have some analog to the Prime Directive and that they're going to leave us be. Leave us alone, not interfere until we reach a certain threshold of advancement.
Yeah.
And then they'll contact us and welcome us to the club, as it were. But I mean, getting back to what I was saying about the implications, if we were to discover that yes, there's a confirmed signal and confirmed it's from an alien intelligence. Aside from the initial panic, I think it would be good. I think it would
Certainly be our best opportunity for having some kind of contact and discourse, as if they were just happened to be so conveniently right next door.
Yeah, but even if, you know, we couldn't contact them and have a dialogue with them for whatever reason, I think just knowing they were there would be a really good thing for us as a species. You know, humans...
We'd have a new enemy other than Russia and China to worry about.
I didn't want to, you know, phrase it quite like that, an enemy. But human beings, you know, we're inherently tribal. You know, it's part of our evolution. We're tribal. We're not as big or as strong as the other large critters on the Earth. But... we have strength in numbers, and we have the smarts to organize. And that's what's gotten us as far as we've gotten. But it's also caused a lot of the problems we have in more recent times. You know, nation against nation, ethnicity against ethnicity, religion against religion. I think having something external that was, you know, at our level...
you think it would
bring us together. It would bring us together in a lot of ways. And just because there's some, you know, external alien thing out there, yes, that would bring us together. Doesn't mean we have to be enemies with it, though. Doesn't mean we have to go to war with it.
No, that's true. And I hope that wouldn't happen. But I also I think it's naive to think that a discovery like that would magically make all our problems go away and suddenly
I think it would help bring people together.
But like you say, we're tribal and a lot of our social structure is based around enemy other.
Yeah.
Right? That's a well-documented thing. We kind of define ourselves by who's not us.
Mm-hmm.
Who are we against? And that's what is one of the kind of foundations of community. Right?
Yeah.
Is that we band together to keep out those aggressive neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And kind of human history is fraught with just extrapolating that to bigger and bigger scale.
Yeah.
And so that would be my fear, is that such a discovery would just immediately launch us into the next rung up that ladder of enemy others.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And what's more threatening than an unknown alien civilization you know nothing about?
Well, you know, if there's, going back to Proxima B, there's just been the one radio signal detected just recently. So, you know, maybe it could be, as I was saying, Proxima B by gaslight. They're at the stage we were 100 years ago.
Yeah, I don't think we might be the enemy other.
Yeah,
we could be the hostile advanced alien civilization.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we see a threat where there's none, and we all of a sudden ramp up our military and space exploration under the guise of this potential threat and go there and find that they're, you know, they're barely out of the Iron Age or something.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we've got the bigger, badder stick and can go and take their resources or something.
You know,
wouldn't that be the thing if we were the alien invaders that we're
so
afraid of?
It's not an angle that's looked at often in science fiction. Usually, you know, we're the ones fighting the uphill battle.
Yeah.
You know, I imagine if it was confirmed there were aliens on Proxima B, even if they were significantly less developed than us, I imagine the military would be making plans.
Totally. Absolutely.
If they're not making plans already.
Yeah. Well, like you say, the UFO UAP conundrum phenomenon is ongoing and seems to be, it's been around a long time, but it seems like it's growing in kind of public attention. And yeah, a lot of people that are deep into these fringe topics would look at this conversation and say, you know, this is old news. Like, they're obviously here. We see them in the sky all the time. There's tons of reports of them landing and talking to people or taking them away. And you guys are way behind the times. But I like looking at things from this perspective. I like using the established data that's right in front of us. Because I wonder about, okay, at what point will we reach that threshold where it's accepted and we can definitively say with absolute certainty that they're out there, right? And that all of humanity, not just kind of the weirdos on the fridge like us, can look at taking the next step into, well, what do we do now once we have that information? How do we make contact? How do we reach out to these people?
Should we reach out?
Should we, yeah. Or should we start hiding, you know?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that gets brought up when people talk about, you know, the Fermi paradox. Like, why don't we see aliens everywhere? Like, mathematically, they must be out there. And one of the possible explanations is maybe aliens don't want to be found. You know, maybe they see other intelligent life out there and they see it as a threat. So they don't readily broadcast their presence. And you know, I mean, we're starting to fall under that category, intentionally or not, because, you know, again, us not having the ability to detect even ourselves, we've only been broadcasting radio for 100 years, you know, and we broadcast a lot of radio during the 20th century. We're not broadcasting as much as we used to. That radio bubble around our solar system that we've been broadcasting, it's slowly fading because, you know, how were we broadcasting things in the 20th century? You know, television was largely over the open air.
Yep.
People listened to radio over the open
air.
Now
it's all through fiber
optic
cables.
Now it's all
yeah,
digital and optical, and we're broadcasting a lot less. And it will probably get even less than that as time goes on, as we develop more efficient and fast ways to communicate and transmit information. So we're not very detectable ourselves. We're getting even less detectable.
Yeah, which, again, speaks to that, the SETI problem. Like, how come they haven't found anything yet? But, yeah, it's for as long as SETI's been around, it's like it's a drop in the bucket, you know, in terms of being able to explore and gather signals and information from the entire galaxy. Wow. Well, that was a really good conversation. I think we should probably get around to wrapping it up here. We're at a pretty good time. How are you feeling? Any last comments? Any last thoughts?
Well, if there's any aliens listening right now, we hope you enjoy the show. Please hit like and subscribe.
Oh, I was looking at my analytics, right, on RSS, and I can see where people are listening from, right?
Mm-hmm.
So And I'm seeing, I've got most of my listeners are right here in Calgary, you know, family and friends. Mm-hmm. There's a couple in Edmonton. There's your girlfriend down in the States.
Mm-hmm.
Some West Coast. There's some San Francisco. There's some Vancouver. And then there's one listener out there from Washington, D.C.
Right? Oh, you're in trouble now.
Right? So in my mind, I'm like, Washington, D.C.? Like, is this the CIA? It's probably because we talked about drones, you know? It's the CIA. That's where my brain goes immediately, but it's probably just some barista in Starbucks.
Probably. Washington.
But hello to my Washington, D.C. Listener out there. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining. That was a very good conversation. A little bit of raw. I feel like this is a little bit of a raw recording today. A couple flubs in there. A little loose, but that's kind of what I wanted. I wanted just a very genuine conversation and to fully explore this idea. So thanks. It's a little different than the way I formatted things before.
No, I this has been fun. Thank you again. I hope you have me back.
All right, great. So I think we'll call it a wrap. Thanks for listening, everyone. And tune in again next week for episode number 6. Have a great night.
Living on the interior surface would have virtually inexhaustible sources of power.
Are you saying you think there are people living in there?
Possibly a great number of people, Commander. The interior surface area of a sphere this size is the equivalent of more than 250 million Class M planets.